It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Here we are, the beginning of the end of the summer. Nothing ever happens in August, right? Congress is going on vacation along with the rest of us. So where do they leave healthcare as they walk out the door? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. Online at elance.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Thursday, everybody. It's the 30th of July today. If you have spent any time at all in or around Washington, D.C., you know that it's not the most agreeable place to be in late summertime. High heat and high humidity combine to make it exceptionally unpleasant, which is why Congress begins its annual August recess tomorrow. The House goes home Friday. The Senate sticks it out for another whole week. They will, though, leave behind some unfinished business. First on the list, of course, the pending health care bill, or rather, bills in the plural. Because our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reminds us that for all the claims of progress there have been, there is still some heavy-duty lawmaking to be done this fall.
Healthcare legislation may be behind schedule, but it is moving. In the House, Blue Dog Democrats yesterday signed on to a compromise that reduces the overall cost of the package and keeps a public option for those who don't have insurance. That deal allowed the Energy and Commerce Committee to take up amendments today. Republicans opposed the tax increases on Americans earning over $350,000 a year. Joe Barton of Texas tried to raise that threshold.
So this is the $1 million taxpayer protection amendment, those that make less than $1 million.
But newly unified Democrats defeated the amendment. New Jersey's Frank Pallone said the extra taxes on the wealthy would be less than 1% of their annual income.
I don't think that's much of a contribution when you're going to cover all these people who have no insurance.
Progress on the Senate side awaits intense negotiations by six senators, three from each party, who are trying to do away with the government option altogether. In the end, reform advocate Alan Garber of Stanford University expects something will pass, but he worries it'll be watered down.
The battle being fought right now is whether we are simply going to have a reform that extends coverage that's pretty much like what we have now to all Americans and will be extremely expensive, or if we're going to take a really deep look at what's wrong with the system and fix it.
He says getting that to the president's desk by the end of the year will take a lot of political will. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
With credit card default rates going up and consumers who still do have good credit using their cards less, today's economic head-scratcher comes to us from Visa and MasterCard. Even though the credit card industry as a whole is expected to lose roughly $70 billion this year, MasterCard announced a huge jump in earnings this morning. Same thing from Visa yesterday. So we asked Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith to find out where the profits are coming from.
MasterCard's quarterly profits were up 26% from a year ago. Visa's climbed more than 70%. Not bad, considering credit card default rates have doubled over the past few years. Banking consultant Bert Ely says Visa and MasterCard don't have to worry when people don't pay their bills.
Their profitability is not affected by people defaulting on their credit cards or having their credit card limits reduced.
Ely says unlike American Express and Discover, MasterCard and Visa don't make actual loans. The banks that issue them do. So if you don't pay your Visa bill, it's your bank that takes the loss, not Visa. If you don't pay your Amex bill, Amex takes the hit because it made the loan. David Robertson publishes the Nilson Report newsletter.
Visa and MasterCard are really intermediaries. They're facilitators. They sit in the middle.
And it's good to be the middleman. Banks pay Visa and MasterCard to issue cards bearing their names. Visa and MasterCard also collect a fee whenever you use your card, and they get a percentage of what you spend. Robertson says one reason profits are up when credit card use is down, Visa and MasterCard have hiked their processing fees. Another reason, debit cards.
Now with the left hand, if you will, credit card spending is down. On the right hand, debit card spending is up. Even in this recession, Americans are simply making fewer and fewer cash and check transactions.
Last year, debit cards made up nearly half of all card use. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Up next, the Humble Podcast. We do it. A lot of other programs do it. A lot of audio and video producers that aren't actual programs do it, in part because it's just so easy. Producers create the file, consumers click download, and boom, it's done. The process behind those podcasts, though, is protected intellectual property. This week, a small company called Volo Media was awarded the patent for podcasting, which is where I say, cue the lawyers. From New York, Jill Barchet reports.
Volo Media's founder, Murgesh Navar, wants podcasters to know he has no plans to shake them down.
Clearly, I can tell you categorically, we're not trying to stop anybody from creating a podcast or distributing a podcast. That is not our intent, our motivation, or even in our selfish interest to do that.
Just as well, says Ernest Grumbles. He's an intellectual property attorney at Merchant & Gould, and he's also an avid podcaster. Grumbles says Volo Media might have trouble defending its patent in court, especially since early podcasting predates Volo Media's 2003 patent filing.
Yeah, I think it's absurd. Given how many things are encompassed within podcasting, for anybody to claim that they have the patent on podcasting, I think is probably ludicrous.
Right now, Volo Media makes money by inserting ads into podcasts for clients like Fox and ABC. Navar says he'll use the patent as a selling point to build alliances with advertisers.
And we acknowledge we have power because of the patent, but we expect to use that power along with our product and technologies to grow the marketplace.
A patent can be a powerful thing. Attorney Grumble says Volo Media's competitors fear that it might use its new patent to bully them.
People who may have declined to do business with them might feel pressure to get into business with Volo Media, to avoid future patent litigation.
Volo Media is assuring everyone it talks to that it's not a threat. But podcasters worry the temptation to abuse the patent might be too much to resist. I'm Jill Barchet from Marketplace.
I don't know if this is necessarily going to make you feel any better or not, but if the markets keep going the way they have again tomorrow, this is going to be the best July for the Dow since 1939. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's been more violence in the streets of Tehran. This is the end of the mourning period for people killed in the protests that followed Iran's presidential election last month. And today, police fired tear gas to break up crowds reported to have been in the thousands. Just after those elections, we spoke with Javad Salahi Isfahani. He's an economics professor at Virginia Tech. He was in Tehran at the time. And we've gotten him back on the line today to ask how politics might play out in the Iranian economy. Professor, good to speak with you again.
Great to be back with you.
You've been back from your trip, 3 weeks or so now, yes?
Yes, about 4 weeks.
What was the mood economically when you left?
I think people were not at that time thinking really about the economy because it was at the beginning of the political tensions. I think I left about 3 weeks after the election. So the mood was still focused pretty much on politics. And the economy was the way it had been before, which is high inflation, and high unemployment.
And in terms of their daily lives, amid the protests in the streets, they could people in Tehran could get what they need. They could go to the market. They could buy and sell if they had to.
Yes, actually, that's a very good question you're asking, because since I've been back and I'm watching the news, I am beginning to get a feeling that everybody gets up in the morning, thinks about where to go to protest. But when I was there, the days when there were protests, you actually had to work hard to find out where it was. When you stepped outside your home, the grocery stores were open, the banks were open, and the people you talked to were all pretty much concerned about their daily lives. And my impression is that that's very much the case still.
What about the population's general interaction with the government on economic issues, taxation and things like that?
Because Iran is an oil-rich nation, that relationship between the government and the people isn't working the way it works in Western democracies, where you pay taxes and you expect services from the government. In Iran, you don't pay taxes and you expect services from the government. And the relation is basically the government gives money to the people and then it expects them to behave. And when they don't behave, it gets very upset.
Yeah, let me ask you about that behavior. You mentioned the political chatter and how people are still thinking about that. What will it be like in, say, a year when, in theory, some of this political chatter has died down and people are trying to get by?
Well, it's a very difficult time from the economic point of view for Iran, because oil revenues have dropped already by about 50%, and that's probably going to continue for the rest of the year compared to previous year. And that means the government has got a deficit to worry about, and the economy has got a trade deficit to worry about. So I think people are very concerned at this point that because of the lack of planning, this landing back to reality, basically, to lower oil revenues is not going to be as soft as it should be, and it could be a hard landing.
Do you think it's possible that economic problems in the near-term future could lead to more political unrest?
It could. It could. I think if the government, under these circumstances, tries to adjust prices, reduce subsidies, the experience of all developing countries, especially in the Middle East, is that if you try to raise the bus fare, it's a small part of people's expenditures, but if there's an underlying political discontent, you will get the whole city erupt. So this political discontent that exists now is about the election, but it could turn into economic issues if the government tries to implement its plans to raise gasoline prices and to remove other subsidies.
Javad Salahi Isfahani is a professor of economics at Virginia Tech University. He's also a guest scholar at the Wolfensohn Center for Development at the Brookings Institution. Professor, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
New Yorkers tend to take their shopping pretty seriously, even when they're not doing a whole lot of it, like right now. Until the recession really took hold, big names like Saks and Bloomingdale's and Macy's ruled the retail scene with giant stores and high-end merchandise. Now a mid-priced chain with humble Midwestern roots is setting up shop in Manhattan, hoping financially strapped New Yorkers might take notice. Kayomi Getz reports.
For weeks, JCPenney has been taunting Macy's.
The real miracle is now on 33rd Street.
And
our neighbors must be shaking in their overpriced boots.
That's Amy Valentine, creative director for Saatchi & Saatchi. It's the firm behind Penny's multi-million dollar ad campaign. She says the ads were intended to speak to New Yorkers like New Yorkers.
New Yorkers make a point with humor and a little bit of aggression, and that's the tone that that we took. But I think it's, you know, if it was pure aggression, that's no fun. It's, you know, it's with a wink.
Tomorrow, Penny's opens its first store in Manhattan's Herald Square, right in Macy's backyard. That's, well, aggressive.
We're stepping up our style, New York. Be the first to get great brands like
Penny's is moving into Manhattan at a time when big retailers like Macy's, Saks Fifth Avenue, and Bloomingdale's have been pummeled by the recession. Consumers who are still shopping have become addicted to deep discounts. Mike Boylson is head of marketing for Penny's. He says he knows what Penny's is up against in taking on Macy's on its home turf.
You know, we're kind of the underdog. We're the new kid on the block. We're the smaller store. There are two things that I will guarantee, though. our competitors and customers will know we're there, and we will take market share out of that area.
Penny's is counting on the weaker economy to help it succeed. Analyst Kimberly Greenberger of Citigroup says affluent shoppers are trading down.
We are seeing a consumer who is receptive to shopping at a lower price, maybe a lower price than she's ever shopped at before.
Greenberger says Penny's can win these new customers if it can shed its lackluster image. The Manhattan store will carry trendy fashion lines by celebrities like Charlotte Ronson. Sephora, the makeup chain, has set up shop inside the store. The dressing rooms have velvet curtains and framed mirrors. And with a nod to Manhattanites who don't like to cart lots of packages around, Penny's will deliver in-store purchases anywhere on the island for $15. Tourists and harried workers buzzed around Herald Square last week as finishing touches were put on the store. Colleen Steele was visiting from Philadelphia. She says she hasn't been in a JCPenney store in years, but she could be lured back.
Maybe. Look, I love the shop. I mean, I'll look in any store. You know, if I like something, I like it. You know, it's not just about the name of the store for me. It's the clothing, service, all that means a lot.
Heather Couture, yes, that's her name, wasn't as impressed. She says Penny's is a place where her mom shops.
I mean, everybody knows JCPenney's, but, like, people don't go to New York to shop at Penny's, you know what I mean?
Couture may stay away, but Penny's is betting its shiny Manhattan store and lower prices will be a strong mix. The store will also give Penny's a jump on the competition. Nordstrom opens discount store Nordstrom Rack in Manhattan next spring. In New York, I'm Kayomi Getz for Marketplace.
Coming up, healthcare that comes with an exchange rate.
We have one thing that no one can beat, which is our location. There's airline flights in from everywhere in Latin America and the Caribbean, and that gives us a very special competitive advantage.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials bounced up 83 points today, 0.9%, closed at 9,154. The NASDAQ floated up 16 points, 0.8%, ended the day at 1984. The S&P 500 jumped 11 points, 0.1%, wrapped up at 986. Credit card companies, as we mentioned, charged ahead, but bump. MasterCard rang up nearly 3% on better-than-projected earnings. Visa followed suit. Shares of the world's largest credit card company advanced 0.2%. That would be Discover. It pocketed 2.75%. More better-than-expected results fueled the rally. Motorola, the biggest U.S. mobile phone maker, dialed up 9.4% today. Industrial conglomerate Tyco International boosted its full-year forecast, sending shares almost 3% higher. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on the fallout from the financial crisis. Watch the Marketplace whiteboards and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases the second quarter gross domestic product report. Author J.K. Rowling turns 44. That Harry Potter dude does really well at the box office. And bring some goodies for the IT department. You need those folks for the health of your server, firewall, and computer stuff. It's System Administrator Appreciation Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. 44 years ago today, President Lyndon Johnson signed a piece of legislation that at the time nobody ever thought would have gotten done. Medicare, government health insurance for people over 65. Presidents before Johnson and since have struggled with health care reform. Brown University political scientist Jim Marone tells that story from FDR to George W. Bush in his new book, The Heart of Power. It's part biography, part health policy paper. And Marone wrote it, he said, mainly because health and illness are pieces of policy that all presidents can relate to. Not that that made changing the healthcare system any easier.
Health reform has always been incredibly, excruciatingly difficult. Harry Truman made it the great cause of his life and got slaughtered in Congress. Truman's advisors finally suggested that he back off a national health insurance and just focus on the elderly. That was the beginning of Medicare, and liberals pushed from 1952 right through 1965 to try to get Medicare.
What was Lyndon Johnson's strategy? How did he go about it?
You know, Kai, the standard story about Medicare is that Wilbur Mills, the great Ways and Means chair from Arkansas, had blocked Medicare for year after year. But after the 1964 landslide, Wilbur Mills changed his mind, and at the last second, he took three separate bills, the administration bill, a Republican bill, and an American Medical Association bill, put them all together and made Medicare Part A, Medicare Part B, which pays doctors, and Medicaid. But now we just discovered some tapes recently released that show Lyndon Johnson was in on it right from the start. He would call Mills over and over again and say, Wilbur, I need Medicare. And Wilbur Mills would say, I can't pass that. I've been fighting it all my life. And Johnson would say, Wilbur, you'll get all the credit. Wilbur, say it wasn't big enough. Make it bigger. And he worked and worked and worked and even suggested the contours of Wilbur Mills's great coup.
Jump with me from Lyndon Johnson to the Clinton administration. We all know the story of that, 93, 94. It doesn't really work because Clinton was so in the details. What was it about that entire episode that made it not go so well?
First, one lesson, Johnson understood this, is speed. You have to move very quickly. And the Clintons moved very slowly. He also split his own coalition, NAFTA, which was a free trade agreement, completely demobilized his supporters. But the great lesson from Bill Clinton, learn to lose. Clinton walked away. He was so eloquent about passing national health insurance. Once he lost, what does he say in his memoirs? I felt bad for Hillary. The result is that the spin about what happened was made by the opponents of the program. And national health insurance, indeed health reform, completely disappeared from the public discussion, as incidentally did the Democratic majorities.
Roll up all of this 75 years of history for me, though. If President Obama calls you tomorrow and says, listen, Jim, I'm in a little bit of trouble here. What do I do? What do you tell him?
Hush your inner economist. There's one scene from this play that goes in every administration. People walk into the Oval Office and say, we can't afford this. The universal lesson of health reform is benefits first, cost control second. And learn how to lose if you've got to lose. Continue the good fight, create a movement, work with Congress.
Aren't we in a position now, though, where we can't not worry about cost?
Of course we have to worry about costs. But if the debate becomes essentially a debate about costs, it just becomes too hard to get through Congress. What Obama's got to do, and I think this has been true for every successful health care reform, what Obama's got to do is remind people of all the pain the health insurance system is causing them and keep that front and center.
James Marone chairs the political science department at Brown University. He is the author of the new book with David Blumenthal called The Heart of Power. Professor, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks, Kai. That was great fun.
The healthcare debate, of course, goes back way before Clinton and Johnson. Hear what Professor Marone has to say about how FDR and the Brits handled it. You can visit our website. It's marketplace.org. While Congress hammers out the last, most difficult details of health care policy, including how to pay for it, some hospitals in Miami are trying something a little different on that score. They are getting the money to come to them by treating wealthy foreigners. From Miami Marketplace's Dan Gretsch has more.
19-year-old Juan Lay is from Peru. Last year, he crunched his ankle in a car accident. The doctors in Peru recommended surgery. Juan Lay wanted a second opinion.
So I came to a hospital here in Miami to see what can doctors say about my ankle.
Dr. Kevin Berkowitz specializes in foot and ankle injuries at Mount Sinai Hospital. Using an MRI, he found Juan Lay had sustained ligament damage. He prescribes physical therapy.
So I'm going to write a script for him for therapy. Voy a escribir otro receta por terapia. And then we'll schedule you to come back in about 3 months. ¿Todo bien? ¿Entiende?
Dr. Berkowitz says he learned Spanish as a resident working in Miami's clinics.
If you go to medical school here, you either are going to incorporate and speak Spanish, or you're going to find yourself on the outside of some incredible medicine.
Juan Lay's father has a good job with a mining company. His family has an international insurance plan. Still, they have to pay the doctor's bill up front, and fees can be 10 times higher than in Peru. Juan's mom, Raquel, says the cutting-edge care is worth it.
My son's health is worth more than all the gold in the world.
International patients spend $3 billion a year on medical care in the U.S. Hospitals around the country are in a race to tap the deep pockets of wealthy foreigners.
You could easily have a patient whose bill runs $1.5 million.
That's Roland Rodriguez. He's heading a push to bring more overseas patients to Jackson Memorial, Miami's financially strapped public hospital.
We have one thing that no one can beat, which is our location. There's airline flights in from everywhere in Latin America and the Caribbean, and that gives us a very special competitive advantage.
Jackson Memorial has teamed up with other local hospitals to market Miami as a healthcare destination. The institutions have ponied up $12,500 each for an initial campaign, and they launched a website, miamihealthcare.org. Cardiologist William O'Neill is with the University of Miami Hospital. He says the profit from foreign patients makes up for losses from treating the poor.
The funds generated are going to be huge to help pay for bad debt and indigent care and non-reimbursed care that we have from U.S. patients. They balance the books.
But some may see an imbalance when struggling Americans get basic medical treatment only because rich foreigners subsidize it. For now, hospitals continue to tempt those flush international patients with lush concierge services.
Good afternoon. Thank you for calling Patient Hospitality. This is Vicky. How may I help you?
Jackson Memorial opened its wood-paneled International Welcome Center 2 years ago. The staff arranges airport pickup, discounted hotel stays, and appointments with specialists. To get into its private quarters, you need to ring a doorbell. Another Miami hospital, Baptist, treated 12,000 foreign patients from 100 countries last year, more than any other hospital in the region. Paul Lopez came to Baptist for cancer treatment from the Caribbean island of St. Croix. He says with Miami just 2 hours away, he rarely sees a doctor on the island.
We have a saying in St. Croix, if you have a headache, you take an aspirin. Other than that, you take American Airlines to get here.
In Miami, I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, listeners of a certain age are going to remember this song, I think. Whiter Shade of Pale by the British band Procol Harum. What you might not know, though, is that the guy who wrote that organ line never got a dime in royalties for it. The British court system took care of that oversight today. The law lords, more or less the UK Supreme Court, said in a ruling on a suit by that organist, Matthew Fisher is his name, that he is entitled to 40% of all future royalties. Should help flesh out the income from Fisher's current occupation. He's a computer programmer in South London. No royalties here, though. It's just Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 83 points, 9/10%. The Nasdaq added 16 points, 8/10%. The S&P 500 gained 11 points, 0.1%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Phyllis Owens, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, those rare home buyers out there still find it difficult to land a deal.
And after a week or two of looking at homes in the process, we were starting to get discouraged.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.